from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a live conversation with Vermont author and documentarian Jim Carrier. His most recent book is Charity, the heroic and heartbreaking story of Charity Hospital in Hurricane Katrina, an account written right around the 10th anniversary of the famous storm. Here's a little information about the book. First went the power, then the water, and for 5 days, the country's oldest hospital was under siege. The never-before-told story of the heroic doctors, nurses, and patients who fought to survive Hurricane Katrina at Charity Hospital in New Orleans. The story traces a remarkable 5-day transformation of an infirm institution caught in a sea of death and indifference into an island of care and tenderness. Jim Carrier is an award-winning journalist, civil rights activist, and filmmaker. He has written 11 books, produced documentaries on civil rights and the banjo, been published in the National Geographic and the New York Times, written Denver Post series on the legacy of the atomic bomb and the Marlboro Man, and produced multimedia projects for the Southern Poverty Law Center. His reporting has been broadcast on NPR, PBS, included in Best American Science and Nature Writing, and he is now based in Burlington, Vermont. His freelance work focuses on medical science and sailing as a contributing editor at Cruising World. Carrier is currently at work on a historical memoir of the Marlboro Man and a science memoir about ulcerative colitis. That's hard to say. He descends from Martha Carrier, who was hanged as a witch in Salem, Massachusetts, which is another interesting tidbit. Jim Carrier has done a lot of cool things, which we might get into, but let's just first get started. He's here live with me. Jim, welcome to Write the Book. Oh, I'm not hearing you, Jim. How about now?
Now?
Yep, there we go. Sorry, that was my fault. well, it's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
Can you hear and can
I can.
All right, awesome. Cool. That's wonderful. So Jim just signed on a few minutes ahead of time like I asked him to, and we had a little trouble with the sound, and then we had a little trouble on my end and his end, and we're finally all here, so that's great. So I just wanted to really tell you how much I appreciated reading Charity, the story of Charity Hospital in New Orleans, and specifically during Katrina. Jim, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about why you decided to write that story and research it.
Well, it was because we went through Katrina. My wife and I had moved down there on August 1st, 2005. She to teach journalism at Loyola University. And we had just got our house set up in Lakeview, which is an area that's 11 feet below sea level, mm-hmm. but surrounded by dikes. And 28 days later, our house was full of water. And we had evacuated that was the very day that she was to start teaching. Of course, Katrina hit, and for a few, we had gone back to Montgomery, Alabama, where we come from, and watched it on, you know, on the television and whatnot. But 3 days later, the dikes broke, and the area that we lived in slowly filled with water, and pretty soon our entire life was underwater. And so we didn't get back there for 45 days. And when we got back, we found basically our entire library of thousands of books turned to paper mache. And we took, a truckload of, basically a pickup load of stuff that we were able to salvage out of there. And we went back to Montgomery. Mm-hmm. I guess, and so when I was thinking about that and wanting to write about it and all of that, I discovered probably through watching CNN the plight of many hospitals, but particularly Charity Hospital, which is was a very famous one of the, it may be the oldest hospital in the country, set up by Sisters of the French. And anyway, we I began reading about it and hearing about it. And once we were able to go back, not to our house early, but to downtown, I began going down there and interviewing doctors and patients, and was able to, basically felt I could write a book about it. And I guess in many ways, it's psychologically an attempt to make something out of a disaster, including my own, which was, you know, all of my works, virtually all my notes, virtually all my writing life had been ruined and underwater, had to be thrown away. So I was kind of starting over. And here was a story that I could use my tools to explain. And so I went down there and found several patients and lots of doctors and interviewed them in the months and the weeks after, and wrote what I thought was at that point basically an outline of a book proposal that I could give my agent.
Yeah.
And to tell you the truth, he was unable to sell it because there was such blanket coverage of that. And then there were some quick histories that came out about it and movies and documentaries and whatnot. We couldn't sell it. So it sat in my computer for a long time.
Had you written just a proposal or had you written the whole thing?
No, just a proposal.
Okay.
And so years later, as you described, I said, well, you know, I got this, I don't know what it was, 20,000 words or something. It wasn't a lot, but it was, I said, I might as well go ahead and put this out on the marketplace and created a self-published book.
Yeah.
And that's the book that you read.
Yeah.
And you know, lo and behold, it sells quite regularly. I probably make $100 a month, you know, just from Amazon, both in paperback and ebooks.
Right. Well, I mean, it's a beautiful book, and it's very well researched, and it's funny. This is a pretty amateur poll, but I did notice that you had over 100 reviews of the book on Amazon, which, for a self-published book, I think that means it's selling quite well and is getting a healthy readership. So that was interesting to me too.
I don't know where they're coming from or how they're hearing about it, whether it's through Goodreads or something else, but. You know, the people who were directly involved with it were early readers, and somehow the word has gotten out. And I think it's inexpensive. You know, the paperback I sell for $10. The $3 or $4 for the ebook, and then I did the audiobook, which, you know, has added a few little pennies here and there. And what I liked about it was that it took a handful of people, and it wove their lives together in a way, and was sort of a complete story in and of itself.
Thank
you.
I was wondering if you might do us the favor of reading the foreword so that people have a sense of the story and of your writing, which is wonderful.
Thanks. Well, you started it talking about how the power went out and then the water and all of that.
Right.
And so it really was cut off, really, from medical gizmos, cast loose by government. Charities manifest found themselves in a boat together. They did not sink into chaos. They found the humankind, affection, and love. Only that can explain why Charity, with the sickest of the sick, lost the fewest lives, 8. Out of 154 reported deaths at flooded healthcare institutions. While a euthanasia scandal enveloped Memorial Hospital and the city's other corporate hospitals evacuated patients with helicopters, Charity hung on with little more than heart. Katrina, as storms do, washed away illusions and exposed weaknesses, the levees, the morally gutted police, a rickety infrastructure, a fragile society that had been living for generations on the take and on the come, and a city and a state and a nation that could not or would not care for its own. Charity's frailties were laid bare, too. It was a sick white elephant. In the wake of Katrina, with a hospital, a dark, hot tomb, its staff laid off and dispersing, an official ambivalence about rebuilding charity eerily echoed the larger debate about rebuilding New Orleans and providing health care for the indigent. In retrospect, the sense of doom is excruciating. Having lived through it by evacuating my own Lakeview home, having watched from afar the storm roar past and the slow tsunami that drowned my dreams, emptied New Orleans, and left charity Art Deco carrion, drama is an inadequate word. The hour-by-hour recreation or recreation of this hospital's final days is one of the most grievous and heroic stories in American history. What survived and soars is this. In a dying city and dying hospital, lives were changed. Patients rose up and lived. Doctors, deprived of their technical toys, embraced their patients for hours on end. Numbers became human beings on both sides of the airbags. As if struck by angels, people walked out of charity changed.
Thank you for reading that. You've got a great radio voice, by the way, too.
That's how I began.
Okay. Well, I thought that was a wonderful opening to the story. And, you know, we do, as we read along, we do get to know some of those people. As you opened the book after the foreword, you did an interesting thing. I loved, and because this is a show for writers as well as readers, and I appreciated this transition that you chose. You introduced the book by talking about the drink called the Hurricane. So, of course, that's about hurricanes, and it's about a drink called the Hurricane. You give us a little history about the drink, the Hurricane, which I never knew. My sister lived in New Orleans for many years, and I never knew that the Hurricane was named for the shape of the glass, which is like the hurricane lamps, the old hurricane lamps. But then you kind of lead us in, you transition from there into a drunk driving accident that lands a patient in Charity Hospital, and you go from there. And that was really interesting to me. Do you want to talk a little bit about opening that way and using that kind of tie-in? It was really quite lovely the way that the hurricane led into that first story.
Well, you know, I was not a great fan of New Orleans when I moved there. We went there because of my wife's job. But I always felt that New Orleans was a party place, right? And I didn't have any particular history with it. It was always hot and humid, at least when I was there. The music was great and all of that. But what I realized, if you spend any time, I'd been there one Mardi Gras. And to an outsider, for me particularly, my overall impression of New Orleans was a place where you got drunk. Mm-hmm. And so I began looking at how much drinking there was going on at any one time. And if you look at and read the history of Charity Hospital, you find that, you know, a lot of the reason patients ended up there is because of drinking. Mm-hmm. And because it's a port, you know, it's a international port. And so you had sailors and with the sailors came everything from venereal disease to, you know, to the various races of folks and a mixture of languages and fights and all kinds of things. So alcohol, while not, I suppose, the only reason there's, I mean, if you go to New Orleans, you'd be hard put not to find people who weren't drinking all the time. I mean, it's really the juice mm-hmm. of the city. Mm-hmm. And then, lo and behold, when you look at the Charity Hospital, you find out that a lot of reasons people go there is because of drink. And so I end up, you know, finding by going through the newspapers at the time, this one case of this young man who had been drinking, celebrating high school graduation, I think it was, and you know, hit a truck. He was out on a four-wheeler with a friend going along top of a dike, and ended up in the hospital. And by then tracing how he was taken care of, and he ends up being, unfortunately, a sad case, because he ends up being a guy who, when the hospital flooded, his body was in the morgue,
yeah,
which was flooded. And then, you know, years, months later, his family, once they drained the morgue, which was in the basement, his family was able to recover his body, identify it in the refrigerated trucks that were outside of town. And so he really illustrated in many ways that. And you know, so that's why I started that.
It's a shocking story. And, you know, I think that it's all this time later, it's amazing to revisit this, because there were so many individual stories, and you're just choosing to focus in on these people, yeah, that were in this particular place. But the whole city had stories. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about some of the heroes that you met and whose stories you share in the book, and how well did you get to know any of them as you interviewed them and prepared to write about them?
Well, I had to chase some of them down, but some of them were still there working. And I mean, the fellow that, there's a guy named Mike Odenay, who is now, I think, in Lafayette. He was the chief resident, and he was around, and I was able to take him. I remember taking him down. We walked down by the river and sat on a bench and started telling about his story. His family had, you know, was from there, and he just loved. He was a big burly guy. He just loved working in the emergency department, and as he say, you know, as a medical student, was able to crack open, you know, somebody's chest and pull it apart and go at it, as they said. And, you know, you saw the thing about charity, because of its history, because it was New Orleans, and because of all the kinds of things, the diseases, the poverty, the accidents, diseases that would come in from outside those folks, the tropical weather and all of that, you saw, and they advertised this actually when they were trying to get residents to come, doctor residents to come and operate there, to work there. They said, you saw the disease, they call them zebras. That's the stuff you don't see often in, you know, up here, let's say in Vermont, you don't see it, these bizarre things. And you see more zebras there, and weird kinds of things that will cross your path as you're a doctor and practicing there, as a young doctor or doctor in training, that you don't see anywhere else.
I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you just to add to that. Yeah. And when I was doing a little research for our conversation today, I ran across a statistic that 70% of the medical staff that's, I guess, physicians that are working in New Orleans passed through Charity Hospital during their training. 70%. I mean, that was really incredible.
Well, Louisiana's right. I mean, if you wanted to get an education, on the whole range of weird things that you could get, and you'd go there. You talked about a couple of people. There was one guy that was a key figure, and I ran into him. I looked him up. I forget how I met him or how I made contact with him. His name, he's kind of a French-sounding last name, but they basically call him Ben de Blah Blah, because it is de Bois Blanc. It's de Bois Blanc, but that is, people who can't pronounce it say Ben de Blah Blah. He was head of critical care, and he was there through that whole thing. Mm-hmm. And he spent a lot of time with me. We went and interviewed in cafes and whatnot, and he told me his whole story about he was going through a divorce, but at the same time, you know, he was there during that whole period, and he was the guy pretty much who, you know, in the ICU unit, kept people away, and he had tremendous memory and these stories he told of carrying people down on back of doors,
right, these, right,
down the black stairways, and then trying to float them across or get them out of the hospital and get them over to what was essentially a parking garage for another hospital, up to the top, and then waiting for helicopters to come. And the whole fight of you know, the other hospitals were came first. I mean, their patients, their families, their dogs were able to get out. And here are these patients who are dying, and did die, in fact, on these cold concrete steps of this parking garage. He just told a horrific story. And so he's the sort of the lead character through this. Mm-hmm. And I, when the book was done, I actually went down and took him a few copies in the new hospital. He was tremendous.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you mentioned the new hospital. That's a very sad part of this story. I mean, this is a hospital. I took a note based on your writing. This is a hospital that was founded in 1736, and it was indeed the first. It's America's oldest hospital, or was, when it still existed. And it treated patients without charge if they didn't have money or insurance. It's unheard of now. And in fact, after Katrina, they did not choose to bring it back. And that made me incredibly sad. Is that building being used for anything else now?
Not yet. Still is. They're debating. There's been a lot of different things. They talked about making it into apartments, or into the city hall, or into a federal courthouse, or whatnot. And there have been developers out there, and to my knowledge, they have not settled on anything yet. Mm-hmm. The one of the most interesting parts, tensions really, that occurred was that a lot of the doctors and nurses and staff went in after the waters receded and started to clean it up because they felt it was still usable as a hospital. And basically LSU, Louisiana State University, came in and shut them down and put gates around it and said, no, we're not going to. They had already decided that they were not going to rebuild this, what they thought was a white elephant. Mm. And so they wanted a new hospital. They wanted a new financial program in which they wouldn't just accept anybody to come in, although they do, but they didn't need a new hospital. And apparently people still can walk in, but now there's, you know, they're much more certain they're to get Medicaid or some other kind of aid and make the hospital pay for itself. So it isn't a drain. Mm-hmm. on the state.
Yeah. Now, you write about charity having been misrepresented as a bad hospital, but you also shared that for every death, there were seven saves, and that they were the designated trauma center for visiting dignitaries. I thought that was really interesting, that it could have this one reputation, even though it had these larger successes. That was interesting to me.
Yeah, you know, the a lot of the famous musicians were born there, were treated there, they felt it. The people in New Orleans, particularly Black folks in New Orleans, felt that it was their hospital. They knew that they could go there and be treated. Mm-hmm. In the old days, really, and there wasn't a day of the year that the emergency room wasn't full. In the old days, they would walk up and the nurse, you know, the triage nurse would say, is your problem above or below the waist? and then they would set them down or figure out where they were going to go from there. But they saw, I mean, you can't imagine some of the doctors that I tracked down who trained there told me these stories of, you know, people would come in, we're talking the poorest of the poor. Mm-hmm. They would come in and let's say they had diabetes. They would find out and they would pull off their shoes and they would find maggots.
Oh, dear.
In eating their shoes because their feet had, you know, were being failed.
Wow.
And it's stories like that, you know, and it took a special kind of, I think, person to work there, But you really had a sense that they were doing God's work.
Yeah.
You know,
although now that you mention that kind of horror in the regular experience of working there, it makes me think that they were particularly well prepared for something like this storm, which everybody had always worried about. And they used to say when the big one comes or if the big one comes. Well, this was the big one. And clearly they knew how to handle an emergency. The story is really quite extraordinary, just the way that they lost their power, there was flooding, they didn't have any fuel for their generators, and yet they all sort of pitched in and people lived. And you had one person who was quoted as talking about how, you know, it took them back to the days of their training before there was so much technology to rely on. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, it was really quite impressive.
Yeah, they had the guy who was basically the maintenance manager of the hospital, who lost his home, lived near me in Lakeview. He had brought in all kinds of generators and brought in they had generators in the basement, but they were, you know, had for years tried to get them above water level. Well, they were in the basement, so they flooded out, and then the whole electrical panels flooded out. But he had brought in generators and had them scattered around, and there were big, heavy-duty things, but guys could lug them around. But they had no fuel for them. And so one of the nurses, I think, or the aides, said, oh, I can get you fuel. So he goes out and comes back with fuel for these generators, and they said, how did, mind you, the city is underwater.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you find this? And he said, well, I used my Mississippi credit card.
Oh, that was
card.
Funny. Yeah.
And the Mississippi credit card was, in fact, you know, he was able to just break into the car and siphon fuel out of them and then bring the fuel back to the hospital. So they did what they could. And to find these doctors, when I would interview them, display, and this is something you don't see with doctors that often, the sorrow and cry when they would lose somebody, and they would have to then carry, wrap this person in basically a sheet, mm-hmm. and carrying them out onto, you know, the stairwell,
mm-hmm.
Where there was no sense that they would be taken care of. I mean, it was hot and humid. And one of the young doctors who was there at the time, when it was all evacuated, he ran up the stairwell where he had left one of his patients dead and cried. And she wasn't there, but he cried at the memory of that. And that was, the doctors now are scattered all over, but I had just a few of them who were involved in it, and then they were also, charity was also, I mean, there was incredible lying going on at the official level.
Right, that's one question I had for you. Why do you suppose there was such ineptitude and corruption right on up the line from the city to the state to our national government?
Well,
in 2 minutes or less. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, really. Well, you know, you know, you have Bush flying over in a helicopter and, you know, saying, you know, Bronnie, you're doing a good job on all of this. And people on the ground knew it was baloney because they weren't. I mean, New Orleans was forgotten. And the charity was, you know, the least among the worries of places that they had problems with. And, you know, who finally evacuated the hospital, by and large, were Fish and Wildlife guys and the Cajun Navy, which were guys who came in, fishermen,
right,
who came in with their own motorboats and took these young doctors cradling preemies, you know, in their arms, and sometimes pumping the bags to keep them alive and taking them over to what amounted to a ramp where hospitals where ambulances were waiting. And they saved incredible numbers of lives that way. Just with this, you know, using whoever came by in a motorboat.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why this story was, I think, so heroic.
Yeah, yeah. I have a question. This is going to seem like a very tiny question as far as the writing of the book, but sometimes you chose to name a character based on a real person. At one point, you talk about someone. I believe she was a resident. I'm not sure, but you describe her as a vivacious, blue-eyed, apple-cheeked redhead. Kurtz Burke had come to New Orleans after college. Anyway, so she's named and she's described. And then sometimes there are characters that you don't describe. And, you know, sometimes it was kind of obvious there was a fairly unattractive character who you gave a sort of pseudonym to, and her story was very personal. Maybe you wouldn't have wanted to name her. But I'm just curious how you made that call. And did you ask people for permission to use their names and describe them? Or do you not have to do that in nonfiction? I don't know.
Well, I do, but I think, you know, when I approached these people, I was saying, I'm writing a book about this, right?
Right.
I'm writing about you, and tell me your story. And you're sitting there in front of them with notepads and a tape recorder. And I didn't ask for releases or anything. I just assumed that they would know that I was doing this.
Yes,
and so,
right.
And I didn't go back and check with them. It's interesting. I don't remember giving anybody a pseudonym. I don't remember what case that was.
I think it was a woman who died. Did she die? I'm trying to remember. You called her Madam X. Madam X.
It may be that I never did know her name.
Yeah.
The doctors didn't know her name.
Oh,
maybe. That's because we were not able, I was not able to track it down.
Okay.
As a writer, a nonfiction writer, a journalist, I would always try to name the person, show them, track, if they were still alive, I would track them down. I mean, that young drug dealer who came in there a few days before Katrina, you know, with his arms basically shot off.
Right.
I was able to track him down. I mean, you know, and to talk about, you know, how he was a drug dealer and was shot up, almost killed, riddled with bullets in some, you know, gang territory fight. And yet they kept him alive, and because that's what they could do there. And I was able to track him down. And then he tells this beautiful story because he had a child by a woman, one of his girlfriends, and they had been evacuated to Texas somewhere. And he ends up being sent out on a plane, where it was, New Mexico, I've forgotten. But he ends up meeting up with his girlfriend and their child. And, you know, you can't, I mean, you stop thinking about him as a drug dealer. He when I went back and interviewed him, he got back into the New Orleans Mardi Gras parade things, and he was doing everything he could to try to straighten his life out.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope he has remained that way. Mm-hmm. So, it really, really did change their lives. The fact that that they were able to keep him alive.
Right. So many great characters and so many great stories. And it's funny because as I was reading about it, I was thinking, like you, as I said, have focused in on this moment in time and this place. But I was thinking, of course, and maybe I'm sure people have, you know, a similar book could be written about the experience of being in the Superdome, or about being in, you know, another shelter. You know, I have my own story of Katrina, but I won't tell it here. But anyway, you know, people have stories, so many stories, and it's just, it's a great reminder that this is one little microcosm of what happened as the result of that storm and the way humanity came together and worked heroically to do what they could.
Can I just mention that?
Sure.
I learned a long time, I think.
Oh, so, I'm sorry. Say that again, Jim, because you tuned out for a second.
I learned this lesson I'm about to tell you a long time ago, but when you come to a place, when you try to go into describe something as big as a hurricane,
yeah,
and a disaster as huge as Katrina, and this is a lesson I used to teach my reporters who work for me. You can't start with a big, huge thing.
Right.
You have to focus in on, you know, the old cliche is your farmer bends down and picks up a handful of dirt and shows him blah, blah, blah. And then from there, you get in to talk about the drought, right, that's going right. through that area. That's a cliche. But you focus on it. And I was reminded of this just recently, because one of the things I'm doing right now is trying to make a book. It is a book out of a series I did for the Denver Post years ago on the 50th anniversary of the atomic bomb. As I go back and try to update all of that, I was reminded of the book Hiroshima by John Hersey. And so I went, there's actually a new book out about how he wrote that book.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, name skips my mind right now, but a friend of mine put it on Facebook and I read it. It was just a wonderful book. It came out last year on the 75th anniversary. And what he did was he was essentially a new reporter or a new writer for The New Yorker. He had a long history with Time magazine, who won a Pulitzer mm-hmm. for the Bell for Adorno. But he realized he read somebody or some book and realized that the way to tell this story, which is the atomic bomb destroying a city, was to choose a handful of characters and follow them. And he went over there, finally got in. MacArthur was trying to keep people out, but he finally got permission to go in. 2 weeks. He had 2 weeks to write this book. It started out as a 30,000-word piece in The New Yorker that took up the entire magazine. I think they left the cartoons out of that particular issue. Mm-hmm. But it 30,000 words, and it was published almost exactly a year later after in 1946, those 30,000 words. And what he did was he went over there and through some Jesuits that he knew and others, he chose six people and they told their story. And I went out and I bought a copy of a little paperback. And it's remarkable the detail. Two of them were doctors, so they could describe what they were seeing, right? And then there was a housewife, and then there was a couple of ministers. And anyway, so he was able to get at this huge disaster, not by talking about the 100,000 people who died, but about what six people who survived saw. Mm-hmm. And the detail that they then provided of people lying and burning to death and, you know, on and on and on, what they saw really made it possible. And that's, I wasn't thinking of John Hersey when I did this book, but the charity book, but that's exactly what I did. I chose three or four, you know, patients, their doctors, followed them to the end. And through them, there were lots of other stories that I would have gotten to at some point. But the people that I interviewed provided enough detail that it captured essentially what happened there.
It rounded out the whole storm and the city's situation. Now, you've just mentioned that book and the book that was written about the writing of that book by John Hersey. So that brings me naturally to a question I ask all of my guests, which is what's a book or two maybe that you've been reading lately that you've really appreciated that you might recommend to listeners?
Well, other than Hiroshima, I thought you might ask me that. And I'm a fan of it.
You tuned out there for a second.
Okay, Eric Larson.
Oh, yeah.
And I first knew him above him because he wrote a book about called Isaac Storm about a hurricane that came in and destroyed Galveston, which I thought really wasn't as good as my book, but but it was a bestseller and it launched his career. And he went on to do The White City about Chicago and he did Thunderstruck and he did Dead Wake, which is about the sinking of the Lusitania. Mm. And what's remarkable about his book, I think, is the reporting. When I made a list of the books that you might ask me about and things that stuck with me,
right,
I realized what drew me to them was the reporting. Mm-hmm. The incredible, he did a book, I think it was called The Vial, something of the Vial, about Churchill. And the incredible work he did in the archives. I mean, it must have taken months and months and months. And then he was able to weave together this detail and put you in the place at the time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's and I've become a big fan of his. And so I would follow him. I would say a couple other people. Of course, I read The New Yorker cover to cover usually, and you know, John McPhee who's now writing a lot of stories about how he used to write. Roger Engel wrote a piece. He was a sports writer. He did a piece not too long ago about, I think he's 80 years old now, maybe 90, about how, what it's like to get old. And it is so beautifully crafted. It's just a piece in the magazine. Right. And then I've gone back because of her death, reading about Joan Didion. And then the other one I'll mention, because I'm also doing a book on medicine, is Atul Gawande, another New York writer who's a cancer doctor, and wrote about cancer and writes about patients. But it's the detail. I mean, of course, they have their patients that they can draw on. And I mean, I could go on and on and on, but those are... that's what it was. They were great, as was Hemingway. Mm-hmm. You know, they were great reporters.
Yeah.
And even people who do great fiction will tell you that it takes great reporting gather the detail that fills your book with authenticity.
Yeah. Now, we're on Zoom. My listeners can't necessarily know that, but I can see you. And in the background, I see a banjo, and I know that you've written about the banjo, and you've done a documentary about the banjo. Yeah. So I take it you play the banjo.
I do.
You do. So
dueling banjos, you know, from
right
is what got me into it.
Oh, really?
I was in Connecticut at the time, and. I'd actually had this operation for ulcerative colitis, and I was bedridden, and my brother-in-law had a guitar that I could play, and I was learning guitar. Well, I was going to a music store for a lesson in guitar, and dueling banjos came on the radio, and I walked in, and there was a banjo hanging on the wall, and I often say that it had a glow around it, because I was just, you know, the music was ringing in my ears, and I bought that banjo and never turned back. And
Dueling Banjos is the one that's in Deliverance, right?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And it's got a whole story. I actually have interviewed the guy who did the music for that, and he's now dead, but. It's really a fascinating story of how that came to be, and the whole story of dueling banjos in and of itself. And there were lawsuits over it because they didn't know that it was copyrighted under another name. And anyway, it's a really good story. So yeah, so I played the banjo, and I've been in a band here in Vermont. Unfortunately, we've been on hiatus for 2 years because of the. Because of the COVID. And then just recently, last week, I'll probably start going again. There's a couple people from the professors and students and have started to gather at the Davis Center at the university every Thursday morning and play old time music. And I'm not an old time banjo player, but I have one, and I'm going to go down and try to get my chops back.
Like fun. That's great.
Yeah.
Now, you've been a journalist, and you're also a documentarian. So is the banjo work that you've, the journalism you did for banjo, was that for a documentary, or was that for?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And is that a piece of work that you're finished with and that people could find somewhere?
Oh, yes. So if you are interested in the banjo and want to know anything about its history, then this actually interesting how this happened, because, you know, I kind of work with found materials wherever mm-hmm. I am. I find stuff and then I write about it to get interested. I was doing a guidebook to civil rights sites, which is still in print, and for Harcourt. And I went up to Hampton, Virginia, where slaves, freed slaves, had been gathered under the Union forces and began, the missionaries came and started schools for them. And they have an art museum there at Hampton University. And I went in there, and there's a beautiful oil, huge oil, showing an old man showing the banjo to a young boy, and they're black. Mm-hmm. And it's so unlike, I'm old enough to actually remember black-faced minstrelsy in upstate New York. My neighbor played in a minstrel show with blackface. And so it had all of these, you know, connotations of stereotypes and all of that. And here is a picture of, by an artist named Tanner, who did the banjo lesson. It's called the banjo lesson. And our piece of artwork, oil, struck me so hard. I thought, this is a joyful picture. This is somebody who's likes to play a banjo. He's passing it on to his grandchild. And what's the story behind this? And so I began digging, and soon enough found out that, yes, indeed, the banjo was came over essentially with the slaves. Uh-huh. At least not the banjo you see today, but gourd banjos. They had gourd banjos, and it comes from a whole family of lutes, stringed lutes with gourds, and that kind of thing from Africa. And they recreated it. And where it all kind of came together was in the Caribbean, where they took, you know, pieces of European instruments and put it together with these strings. And so the slaves were passed it on. Well, they sort of abandoned it, in part because of the cliches and the stereotypes, but they passed enough on to blackface minstrelsy. It became the whole basis of music during the minstrel era, which continued right up until the 60s in places.
Yeah.
Anyway, it turns out that there was a music librarian from Chicago, originally Milwaukee, named Dina Epstein. And I was living in Madison, Wisconsin at the time. And I tracked her down, and she had done a book called Sinful Tunes and Spirituals, Black Music Before the Civil War. And she had discovered that black music was thought to be derivative of white music, that that slaves didn't have their own culture, that they didn't have original songs like that. And she also then discovered that missionaries had collected the slave music there along the coast during the Civil War era, and wrote it down. And the diary of one of these guys is actually in the library at University of Madison, University of Wisconsin Madison.
The diary of one of the missionaries.
Yes.
Wow.
And in the diary, he's pasted in musical staffs, and one of them is "Row the Boat Ashore." Michael, row the boat ashore, with a tune to it, right in with musical staffs, right in, pasted into the diary. That song came when he heard it when he was being rowed from the ship to the shore by slaves, or ex-slaves at that point. And so I thought, this is amazing. And so I found her. She was just starting to develop Alzheimer's, but she still could interview her. And I'd interviewed her, and then I went and interviewed a number of black and white musicians who knew of her work. What she did really was reintroduce us to the memory that the banjo was a black instrument, mm-hmm. originally a black instrument. And enough, you know, there were actually tutors out there showing how to play. And anyway, so I've interviewed all these various historians and musicians, including the members of the Chocolate Drops, Carolina Chocolate Drops, Rhiannon Giddens, and others who really owe their kind of, you could say they own their careers to her work. Mm-hmm. And she really changed the face of our, and began what we now take for granted, that the African Americans are at the basis of so much of American music.
Right. What's I'm sorry. What's the name of the documentary that you made?
The name is called The Librarian and the Banjo.
Okay.
And it's on Amazon Prime.
Okay. All right.
And
cool.
It's, I think you can even find it on YouTube. But yeah, it's, and it's an hour long documentary. And,
oh, that's great. That's great. So. I have time for one last question, and I always like to close with a question about advice. And as a journalist and documentarian, I thought I would ask you, what advice might you have for other writers who would like to take on a project? You know, it's funny, originally when I wrote the question, I was thinking a project like Charity, which perhaps exposes the flaws in a system or shows people coming together to fix a problem. But, you know, hearing you talk about your work on the history of the banjo, just it's all very fascinating. So to me, I guess my question is, let's say a writer has something that's just striking him or her as fascinating. What advice do you have about turning that into some piece of work?
Well, I think, you know, you need a storyline. You need, and that's why characters are so great. If you can find one person that can tell that story and develop that story behind, around them. I think being a good writer, and I've already talked about this a little bit, you need to be a vacuum cleaner for detail.
Yeah.
History and all of that. And then, you know, the crafting is, you know, that's the beauty of writing. Any of writing is taking all this stuff and putting it into a logical form, finding a way to open the story. And I think in the best way is to open it in a miniature way or a tiny handful way, that so you can actually somebody can identify with, and then broadening it out and adding characters and adding detail. And I think, you know, Hemingway, said it best. You include the detail that expresses the emotion. The emotion is what you're trying to create in any kind of book or as passage or sentence. Even you're trying to create a authenticity, and it comes down to emotion. And you include just the detail that makes that happen. And then you throw the rest away. That's mm-hmm. difficult, mm-hmm. but you get that storyline and you get the detail that when you're at that spot in that moment, and then throw the rest away. And I think you have to trust the first reader. That's the second thing that, as an editor, I know it's very difficult, but you need to hand that book to somebody and say, read this and tell me what you think. And it's agony, you know, waiting for them to come back. And you need to trust the fact that they're going to give you an honest feedback and tell you what's right and wrong with this thing, and then take it from there.
Okay, that's fabulous advice. I want to mention again that I've been speaking with Jim Carrier, who's a writer in Burlington, Vermont. We were talking about his book, Charity, The Heroic and Heartbreaking Story of Charity Hospital in Hurricane Katrina. I'm going to just take a musical moment here to say goodbye to Jim, and then I will be back with the Bookworm's calendar for the coming week. From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. So you've just listened to my interview with Jim Carrier, and I want to just give you the write the book prompt for the coming week. Consider these famous catastrophes and either research or imagine a single story from the incident to write about. As we discussed when I talked to Jim, it's very helpful to share the story of one person or a small group of people, that you can include specific and salient details that might help to lend the story more grit, as it were. So here are some famous catastrophes, and write a scene or a story, a poem, or just a paragraph. I'm going to start out with hurricanes. Hurricane Katrina, Sandy, Charlie, or any hurricane that might move you to write about. Tohoku earthquake and tsunami and the related Fukushima nuclear disaster is another one. And then on the smaller scale and historically longer ago, the Hindenburg. So those are three stories that really have so many stories that you could tell. And if you imagine a character or learn something by researching and writing a little something about that. I wanted to also mention that you can learn more about Jim's work at his website, jimcarrier.com. I am a little tight on time for the Bookworm's calendar today, and there's a lot going on, so I would encourage you to have a look. There's a wonderful calendar page, for example, on 7 days, if you want to know what's going on around town for writers and readers. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, all the sites. You can also visit Write the Book on social media sites like Facebook and Twitter, and on my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a wonderful week.